Hello and welcome to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wherry, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Have the Harper Conservatives broken their own anti-terror laws with a new attack ad against Liberal leader Justin Trudeau? The new ad uses an ISIS propaganda video, and the opposition believes that's a breach of the recently passed C-51. We hear from Liberal MP Chrystia Freeland.
Canada now has American-style PACs. Political action committees not officially connected with parties are known for attack ads and attempts to influence votes before an election. They raise serious questions about fundraising and election laws. For more on this, we speak with the former head of Elections Canada, Jean-Pierre Kingsley.
Former Conservative MP Dean Del Mastro has been sentenced to jail time for breaking Canada's election laws and then trying to cover it up. The former point man for the Prime Minister was led out of the courthouse in shackles. The McLean's panel discusses the impact this may have ahead of the fall vote.
The proposed memorial for the victims of communism has sparked more controversy. The design has been changed after critics say the Conservative government made last-minute changes to stack the board of the National Capital Commission. The NDP's Paul Dewar weighs in.
For your politics, for your power, welcome to The Hill. The Conservative Party is being accused of breaking its own anti-terror laws after releasing a new attack ad. The ad uses promotional videos from ISIS showing militants with guns and hostages tied up and put in cages just before their deaths. The ad then plays a news clip of Liberal leader Justin Trudeau explaining that he would end the airstrike mission in Iraq and Syria. The reason for that is that the Liberals want to focus on military training for Iraqi troops rather than engaging in a combat role. Prime Minister Stephen Harper was quick with criticism, saying this is the wrong path to take with a group like ISIS.
A group that is planning, has executed and is planning attacks against Canada and Canadians. I think on behalf of both Justin Trudeau and Thomas Mulcair, their positions on the military mission in Iraq and Syria, their mission against ISIS is irresponsible electoral politics, and I think most Canadians understand that.
But it's the ad that's prompting questions about the use of ISIS propaganda in a political attack. Under Bill C-51, the government's own anti-terror legislation, which recently became law, it is illegal to knowingly advocate or promote the commission of terrorism offenses in general. It also gives judges the power to seize and destroy any terrorist propaganda that Canadians may have.
So, did the Conservatives contravene these laws? Well, we'll let you know what the Tories have to say in a moment. But first, I speak with Liberal MP Chrystia Freeland. What was your initial reaction when you saw the ad with ISIS promotional video imagery being used to attack your leader?
Look, my reaction was shock and outrage. It is really a new low for Stephen Harper to be using ISIS promotional videos in Canadian politics. You know, it says to me that there is no moral compass here. This is not about values. This is absolutely cynical. And it also says to me that this government is really scared of Canadian voters.
Do you think that using the ISIS imagery in an attack ad like this is a breach of Bill C-51, the anti-terror law that the government just recently passed?
Look, I am not a judge, but certainly to me, it seems like a direct contravention of a law that this government fought for. You know, what is so outrageous about this is these ISIS propaganda videos are out there because ISIS wants to push them out there. You know, this government is doing ISIS's work for it. And I am really outraged that this government is doing that. It shows to me that there is no moral compass here. This is not for them about values. It's not about achieving any foreign policy goals. There is no low to which they will not stoop in an effort to scare Canadians.
There could be an argument that they're technically not promoting what ISIS is doing. They're using it in a different context, and therefore they may not be breaking the law for C-51. How would you respond to that argument?
Look, I am not a judge, and it is up to our fine judiciary, which I as a liberal respect very much, to make those sorts of fine judgments. What I can speak to is the morality of doing this and the absolute political cynicism which it shows. Now, this is wrong on so many levels. It is wrong to be spreading ISIS's message, and it is absolutely wrong and absolutely outrageous to use this kind of crude propaganda, which is, by the way, the propaganda invented and created by the very people who we are out there opposing, in a sort of naked effort to hang on to political power in Canada.
So based on the fact that you think C-50, you think that this is a direct contravention of C-51, will the Liberals be making a criminal complaint about this attack ad?
We are looking into all of our options. What I think is really important is for Canadians to appreciate the absolute outrageous cynicism of this government, which, you know, has stooped to being a PR agency for ISIS. You know, we should not be, any of us, spreading ISIS's propaganda. ISIS has put this stuff out there because they want it to be used. They want people to be viewing it. They want people to be seeing it. I don't want that. I don't want to help ISIS, and I hope the Conservative Party doesn't want to do that either.
So you're not ruling out a criminal complaint at this time?
As a party, we're looking at all of our options. To me, the really important point here is the moral and ethical point, and that's what I'd like Canadians to focus on.
All right, so let's talk about what was behind this ad. The Conservatives were not happy with the fact that Liberal leader, your leader, Justin Trudeau, came out and said that if he forms government, he would end the air combat mission against ISIS in Iraq and Syria. In conversations with some Conservatives and in an interview with the Veterans Affairs Minister, he says you need that security of the airstrikes to help the Iraqi forces on the ground advance and take down ISIS militants. Without that security, they could be led to the slaughter. On top of that, he says, you know, this is a group that has targeted Canada, so not only would lives be put at risk, but also Canadian security could if ISIS is allowed to grow further. Do you not think that there's an argument here to continue the airstrikes?
Look, I would first like to point out that this is an absolutely invented, trumped up news story. The Liberal Party position has been clear on this for many months and was made clear in two parliamentary votes. Our position on Iraq and on ISIS is absolutely the correct and reasonable one, and the one that has the best chance of actually securing and enduring peace in that troubled, troubled country. What we are saying is, as government, we would continue and very seriously look into expanding a stepped-up military training role. That is something Canadians are good at. And that is where we think we can best support the people of Iraq in this important fight. I think it's really important in thinking about our strategy in confronting ISIS to understand that ultimately, people who are going to defeat ISIS are the people of Iraq. And that is why the most effective help that Canada can give is to help train Iraqis to fight this war, to fight their war. We have to support the forces of progress and modernity in Iraq so that they can win this war and support, continue to support the Kurdish Peshmerga.
But it was the Iraqi government and the Peshmerga that asked for coalition help to fight ISIS.
There is a broader coalition which we as government would very much continue to be an integral part of. We absolutely believe that the way that Canada can be the most effective is in our role, which we are very good at as military trainers, and that is a role that we are very open to considering increasing. And by the way, we think this is the most important part of the struggle, to help the Iraqis, to help the Kurdish Peshmerga fight their own fight and win it, which they will.
If the brutal tactics of ISIS is not enough for Canada to get involved in a combat mission, what is?
So let me be very clear here. We are fully committed to the global effort to confront ISIS, and we are fully committed to being a strong participant in that effort and to strongly supporting our allies. When it comes to the Canadian combat mission, I think it is very clear, very important to be clear, that this is an ill-defined mission. It has no concrete objectives. It has no exit strategy. That's something that Canadians need to be very wary of for Canada.
That was Liberal MP Chrystia Freeland discussing the new attack ad from the Conservatives and the Liberal position to end the airstrikes in Iraq and Syria. Now, the Conservative Party is responding to these allegations. In a statement, a Conservative spokesperson says, quote, "What an absolutely ridiculous assertion. We're going to make no apologies for reminding Canadians of the sheer brutality of ISIS, a terrorist group both Thomas Mulcair and Justin Trudeau don't believe is worth fighting."
Still to come on the show, American-style super PACs have popped up in Canada. McLean's panel weighs in on Dean Del Mastro getting a jail sentence, and we talk about why the Conservative government is being accused of stacking the deck over a Victims of Communism memorial.
Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for McLean's Magazine.
Coming up on the show, the McLean's panel discusses the impact of the jail sentence given to former MP and point man for the Prime Minister, Dean Del Mastro. And we look at the controversy over a memorial to the victims of communism. But first...
With the Conservatives, you and your family just aren't in the picture. The Harper Conservatives. They won't be there for you.
American-style super PACs are here. That is an advertisement from a group calling itself Engage Canada. It's one of several third-party political groups of the sort that are normally seen south of the border, but have been popping up here in provincial elections. Well, now they've gone federal.
The point of such a group is to be separate from political parties, but still raise money, produce and air attack ads, and influence voters ahead of an election. During the writ period, they would be facing restrictions, but before the writ is dropped, they can pretty much do as they please. The PACs can accept union and corporate donations with no limit and no requirements to disclose who is giving them cash. While Engage Canada is obviously on the left side of the spectrum, Harper PAC jumped in soon after with hopes of representing the right.
Trudeau says Canadians are cynical, and that's why we don't like him. If Trudeau is so immature that he blames Canadians for his problems, can we really trust him to make hard decisions as Prime Minister?
But alas, it was not to be for Harper PAC. Less than a week after its launch, its director pulled the plug on the project. Conservative leadership was angry over the fact the Prime Minister's name was tied into the group.
The presence of these groups raises serious questions about political engagement and advertising outside of the writ period. To talk more about this, I spoke with Jean-Pierre Kingsley, the former head of Elections Canada. So, Mr. Kingsley, I guess first of all, the idea of third-party advertising isn't necessarily a new issue, but what concerns you about what the situation is now and what's going on?
Well, the problem with what is going on now is that there is absolutely no law, no legal obligation put on anyone who interferes somehow or participates, let's say, in the electoral process before the writ is dropped. The only law that applies once the election officially starts. So we have a situation, for example, where what we're calling third parties can spend any amount of money they want, can neglect to tell us who they are, not tell us who their contributors are, not telling us how much those contributors are contributing, and those contributors could be non-Canadian sources. So that's the main preoccupation. What we've done effectively, what they're doing, is putting aside the level playing field for which, you know, we spent 40 years building in this country to control the money in politics. This is all out the window.
Does it concern you as well? I mean, political parties are subject to different rules of disclosure, but does it concern you as well the amount of advertising that occurs by major political parties before the writ is officially dropped?
Yes, it does. Because once again, they're sidestepping the very law that they passed in Parliament and taking advantage of the fact that a piece of legislation called fixed election dates was passed without any form of control on the money or regulating of the money or the players before the actual writ is dropped, before the actual period of election starts. And I find that regrettable. I find both regrettable. I also find regrettable the fact that the government is doing so much advertising with public monies, so much advertising that is not related to what is usual during an electoral period. When there's an election that is officially called, government, federal government, can only advertise if it's related to public health, public safety, the environment, or something which is time sensitive.
So how would you regulate in terms of political advertising, in terms of party advertising, in terms of third party advertising? How could you regulate it between RIP periods?
Well, what we need to do is, you know, come to grips with the fact that after this election is over, even if everyone were to do exactly what I've just asked, which would surprise me, but everyone stopped advertising, the government would only do the kind of ads I said, even if that was to occur, we need to look at this after this election and find a way to make that electoral period start much earlier, 6 months, 8 months, 9 months before, so that then the rules would apply to the players, all the players, at that time. We could regulate third parties, we could regulate political parties, and we could regulate government advertising all at the same time.
So you would essentially set up a period of say, you know, 6 months before an election date. You're only allowed to do X, Y, and Z?
Amount of money that you can spend, and you must reveal the sources, and you must tell us who you are, and this is the maximum contribution that can be made by anyone. I would extrapolate frontwards all the rules that we have now during the electoral period. That's what I would do.
How would that work, though, in terms of Senator Dawson in the Senate has proposed something sort of similar that tries to put a limit on it. The one problem in that case is that if we're dealing with a minority parliament in a situation where an election could occur at any time, how do you account for that sort of ambiguity?
Well, I'll tell you, that we accounted for it before, because even though we had majority governments before, we did not know when the election officially would take place. And the amount of government advertising and third-party advertising was not extensive. If the government party started to advertise, then the message would go out. And so, there was not a lot of it. Now, there's also some major advertising taking place by a couple of political parties way beyond that time. And I would say, let's not worry about that at this time. Let's worry about what's happening right now for the 6 or 8 months before the election. If it's a minority government, you know, no one's going to be advertising before the fact. Not in a major way. And nor with third parties. This is the regime we had before.
Because you think that there would be some kind of deterrent, like the ambiguity would be a deterrent on advertising, essentially?
That's exactly the point. That's what it was in the past. Now, if it turns out that I'm wrong, then we'll have to think about it again and see what it is that we need to do to regulate advertising between elections, between complete elections.
There is, I guess, an argument to be made that why should we have any restriction on advertising spending on at least in terms of political parties, in terms of political groups that want to advertise? You know, this is just part of the political process. It's free speech. Why should we have any restrictions on the amount of money that can be spent in that regard?
Well, that's a straight extrapolation of the American system, which is something we've turned down. You know, in the United States, the Supreme Court has said free speech is ability to spend as much money as you want, any which way you want, political purposes, any purpose. In Canada, we said, no, this is what we did during election periods. We said we want to regulate this. At that time, we were not concerned between elections because of the phenomenon that I've just discussed with you. At the heart of it is, what is free speech? What is, the level playing field in our electoral system? And the point is that you have to regulate the money. It's the toughest nut to crack. It took us 40 years to crack it, and we let it go in one fell swoop. So I'm not in favor of letting that jungle come back into our politics.
You would argue fairly strongly that we're better off having fairly tight restrictions on what can be put out there.
Call it tight restrictions. I call it the regulating. Let us agree on how much it is that is a reasonable amount. Let us agree on what the contribution limit should be. Let us agree on what they have to tell us if it's a third party. We've already decided all that, by the way, and this was approved by the Supreme Court, because this law was brought to the Supreme Court for contestation, and the Supreme Court said, this law is perfect. Don't touch it. So I'm saying, why not extrapolate that forward and regulate the environment to the satisfaction of Canadians? We play the game differently, and I think we're ahead of that game. We were the world leaders on money in politics, and I don't know how far back that pushes us. It does definitely push us back 40 years in terms of our own achievements.
As a chief electoral officer, did you ever conceive of the idea that there would be a fair amount of advertising between writ periods, or was this
As a matter of fact, when the fixed election date legislation was before the House, I went before a parliamentary committee and raised that possibility and said that we should at least regulate what political parties are going to be doing. But that was set aside, and the law passed as proposed without taking into account the fact that we were foreseeing some of the consequences. People just decided, let's take a chance, let's see what happens. And I'm sure that there are people out there now who are doing this, you know, part of the third parties, even the political parties. They will be weighing what is the impact of our advertising and deciding how best to do this next time and how to do even more next time. This is the real concern. This is another real concern here.
And how, would you also repeal the fixed election date legislation?
Well, I'm severely tempted to do so. I know a lot of people favor it. But, you know, it's one of those pieces of legislation that doesn't quite fit with the British parliamentary system that we've adopted, not only inherited, but we've adopted it. And we keep adapting little pieces that become big pieces when we realize what it is we've done.
That was the former head of Elections Canada, Jean-Pierre Kingsley, discussing the emergence of third-party political groups in federal Canadian politics.
Still to come on McLean's on the Hill, Dean Del Mastro, a former MP and former point man for the Prime Minister, has received a jail sentence, and there's been another dust-up in the controversy surrounding the memorial for the victims of communism. Welcome back to McLean's on the Hill.
Still to come on the show, we take a look at the latest controversy surrounding the memorial to the victims of communism. But first,
it's now time for the McLean's panel. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio, and I'm joined, as always, by McLean's Associate Editor Aaron Wary and McLean's Political Editor Paul Wells. Thanks very much for being here, guys.
Thanks.
All right, so this week, former MP, former Parliamentary Secretary to the Prime Minister, Dean Del Mastro, was sentenced. He's receiving jail time, 1 month in jail, plus house arrest, and I believe a year and a half of probation for breaking Canada's election laws and then trying to cover it up because he overspent in his campaign. He's been released on bail now, pending the appeal to the conviction, but those images of him leaving the courthouse in shackles must be damaging in some way to the Conservatives. Paul, do you want to tell us what you think the impact is of this sentencing?
Yeah, I can't imagine worse images than the guy who used to stand behind the Prime Minister in leg irons. And he got there by applying to real life the lessons that he had learned in the weird atmosphere of question period. Not just this government, but its predecessors learned early that you never apologize, you never explain. If you get asked a question, you say, well, I disagree with the question, and so on and so on. That works to some extent in electoral politics, but it's a bad rule to apply to a court case. And at the sentencing hearing for Mr. Del Mastro, the prosecution read back all of the quotes he had given in scrums in which he indicated that he thought a guilty plea was just the judge's opinion and he didn't think he had anything to apologize. And they said, this is to demonstrate there's not a whiff of contrition about this man and therefore the sentence has to be harsh. And it was. So if at any point he had acted like a human being who recognized his own fallibility, it might have weighed on the judge's decision. If not on whether to convict, then certainly on the gravity of the sentence. But what he learned was put on some kind of tough front, and he is now very literally paying the price for that.
And I guess the judge obviously didn't take too well to the tough front, but the Conservatives are coming out just saying simply the same lines as we heard from the whole Duffy scandal. If you broke the rules, you need to pay the price for that. Do you think that's going to fly, Aaron, with voters?
I suspect not. I mean, it's tough to figure out how big a problem this is. Obviously, it doesn't help. I think it'll be interesting to see whether the footage that is out there now of him being led into the police van gets used. I would think the Liberals, with their commitment to not going negative, wouldn't be able to use that footage. It'll be interesting to see whether maybe the NDP in the closing days of a campaign rolls it out. I don't know whether any one case like this has a major impact on the government of the day, but I do wonder whether it's just an accumulation of things. When you can rhyme off Michael Sona and Arthur Porter and Mike Duffy and Dean Del Mastro and In and Out and all these sorts of things, it starts to sound pretty bad, and it adds to the exhaustion factor. Governments tend to just sort of wear out their welcome eventually. That said, the Conservatives weren't going to campaign on ethics and accountability. They were going to campaign on tax cuts. So, it'll be interesting to see if it has any impact, but I don't think it changes much in terms of the questions the parties were going to throw at people.
But they gain power on the issues of ethics and accountability. So, Paul, how do you think this might play in the fall vote?
Well, I mean, to some extent, I'm not sure it matters hugely what use the parties make of the footage, because the footage is out there, it's been seen. I mean, and the Conservative response usually on what they call process questions, which is, were parliamentary niceties paid proper attention to and so on, is that's way over the head of ordinary people, distracted voters who don't have a lot of time for politics, can't figure all this stuff out. Yeah, that's the problem now, because even if I'm not sure why Dean Del Mastro was wearing leg irons, I saw them. And so that's why I don't think the extent to which they become part of the discourse matters so much as the fact that, hey, that guy's wearing chains. I used to see him standing behind the prime minister. I think the damage is already done.
All right, let's move on to the super PACs. That became a big issue this week when we heard about the Harper PAC being formed, where Conservatives were going to launch some ads to counter, as they say, the Engage Canada PAC of more left-wing unions and other cash. Well, we don't really know exactly who's giving money because we can't see the donation list. Aaron, do you think there's going to be much of an impact from these specific PACs, even though Harper PAC has now folded less than a week after it was launched? But do you think they really do have an impact on votes?
I don't know. I think that really remains to be seen. I don't see much evidence that these groups yet have the sort of money that they could throw around to make a big ad buy and really be a force out there. They do add to the discourse. They, if they do manage to get big TV buys, they could have an impact. But at this point, it's sort of an unknown quantity. I mean, even Harper PAC, which people got very excited about, I don't think we had any idea that, or any idea of whether it was going to amount to anything or whether they were going to run ads in any kind of significant number. We are now going to have a discussion about how to regulate sort of advertising and spending between elections. I think that's now pretty much unavoidable. Generally speaking, in the abstract, I think there's a decent argument to be made for more ads, more talk, more discussion. It's all fine. Don't worry about it. But if we take as the standard, the fact that we regulate it during the campaign period, and we see some value in kind of establishing a level playing field, then I think we have to figure out how to level the playing field between elections.
So do you think, Paul, that there should be some rules to try and to get this out of the way, to make sure that there is a level playing field, if you will, with these super PACs?
My own preference is for fewer rules. My own preference is for more political speech and not less. And even though that means that speech will follow money, that the larger the donations, the more powerful the ad campaigns, I don't think it follows at all that opinion follows money. The classic example in modern times is the 1992 Charlottetown referendum, where every newspaper chain, every government, and the great majority of the corporate money in that campaign was telling people to ratify the Charlottetown Accord, and the Charlottetown Accord failed because people have their own minds. And I do believe the conservative groups have a point, which is that union money is pretty easy to line up in this country. My own union, Unifor, is helping to support the one of the anti-Harper campaigns. I don't know which one. I don't like that one bit, and there's not much I can do to stop it. And corporate money is harder to line up, especially because it's spoken for. The Conservative Party is trying to get that money. A bunch of ineffectual partisan gadflies like the broadcaster Ezra Levant, he hits up his mailing list about three times a week. And at the end of the day, I don't know how much extra money there is to pay for these PAC ads. The people I know who try to scrounge up money on behalf of the Conservative Party tell me that it's hard going. So this isn't the United States. And even if people try to approximate American techniques, I don't know if they're going to get American results. Incidentally, this week, American results don't look very friendly towards conservative causes.
Now, I had a couple of conversations with some conservatives about this whole PAC issue, and many of them say they, in general, do support the right having a PAC to try and counter what the left is doing, but this one failed, and this one specifically ticked off the conservative leadership. Do either of you, can you weigh in as to why that happened exactly?
I think it was a mistake to call it Harper PAC. I don't think you can, if you want to be an arm's length organization, I don't think you can align yourself with the name of the leader and expect there not to be problems with that. Because if they had screwed up, it would have been pinned on the conservatives. And you know, you can't, if you're going to be an independent voice, I think you have to kind of give yourself some kind of silly title like Working Canadians or
Working families
or Engage Canada. I think that's a problem. I mean, I also don't know whether, I mean, I suspect the conservatives could use the help or might appreciate the help, but I think they're also sort of have their own operation going. And in terms of messaging, it might be easier for them to kind of keep that all in-house.
Paul, have you heard anything about what happened behind the scenes with all of this?
No more than I read in the Toronto Star, which is that Harper decided he didn't like this. And that the main organizer of the Harper PAC, Stephen Taylor, uses that as a badge of his own right behavior. And I think that's probably true. There was no close coordination between Harper PAC and Harper. There was, in fact, a care taken to make sure that they were operating at arm's length, and they led to the result that it did. I think the choice of the name Harper PAC is telling, because it reminds us once again that the only guy who knows the tune here, the only guy who really knows what Harper conservatism is or sounds like or how it acts, is Stephen Harper. And with this, as with Stephen Taylor's previous effort, the mighty Tim Hortons boycott after Tim Hortons stopped running ads for Enbridge, the oil company, it's surprising to see how many people jump to participate in something that sounds like it might be Harper-esque, even when Stephen Harper doesn't want to touch it with a barge pole. It suggests that after he's done being leader of the Conservative Party, there'll be a period of turbulence and chaos as people try and figure out how to hum this tune without the boss leading in the song.
And we'll have to wait to see what happens there. Thanks very much. Really appreciate your time and your thoughts. Maclean's political editor, Paul Wells, and Maclean's associate editor, Aaron Wary. And I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
Coming up after the break, we talk about why the Conservative government is being accused of stacking the deck over a memorial for the victims of communism.
Welcome back to Maclean's on the Hill. I'm Cormac McSweeney, Parliament Hill Bureau Chief for City News and Rogers Radio.
And I'm Aaron Wary, Associate Editor for Maclean's Magazine.
Well, sometimes the issues that end up mattering on Parliament Hill are hard to predict. When the government first proposed a monument to the victims of communism, it didn't seem like a politically risky proposition. But opposition to the monument has grown steadily since early this year. There are two issues around all of this. The first is the prominent location, which is adjacent to the front lawn of the Supreme Court of Canada. It had been set aside for a future federal court building. Critics say that plan should never have been changed. And the second issue is the design, an imposing concrete structure that's drawn criticism from architects and experts.
This week, the National Capital Commission, the federal agency overseeing the project, showed off revised plans for the controversial monument. Officials said the new plan for a smaller monument fits better with the architecture of the historic Supreme Court building. But critics weren't satisfied. NDP MP Paul Dewar represents the Ottawa riding, which includes the parliamentary precinct where the monument is supposed to be built. McLean's Ottawa bureau chief, John Geddes, spoke with him by phone about the scaled-down monument plan.
We're interested in what has transpired this week on the design plan for the Controversial Victims of Communism Memorial. It's planned to go, many of our listeners will know, right near the Supreme Court of Canada. You've been opposed to it. Did you see anything that reassures you in the plan that's been put before the National Capital Commission?
No. What we saw, John, was that we had the government do two things that were making, frankly, matters worse. First, they very quietly and deceitfully, I will say, put into play appointments to the NCC board. Five appointments made went out late yesterday. We had former mayor of Ottawa pushed aside.
That's Jackie Holtzman.
She was pushed aside to make way for new partisan appointments. So that was the first thing that was stunning, frankly.
And that was, you think that was in order to get a more agreeable NCC board when it comes to this Victims of Communism Memorial?
There's no other way to read it, frankly, because we've seen this government wait till for years with agencies, boards, and other crown corporations not filling positions on those boards or extending them, right? It could have easily extended the mandate of some of these board members. But when you see former mayor of Ottawa, Jackie Holtzman, who was not happy with the way things were going on the monument project, pushed aside to bring in, you know, fresh new partisan appointments, I can't understand, you know, any other reason. And there's certainly, to me, it's very clear what their intent was, and that is to put in people who would push through this project.
So we have new members on the board, perhaps put there to make the board more agreeable to this project. But the project itself, which has been controversial, a very imposing concrete structure right in the sort of front yard, as it will, or not quite, kind of just over from the front yard of the Supreme Court. You didn't think that the plan that they put forward to scale it down was at least a step in the right direction?
No, I'll tell you why. It's just a smaller version of a bad idea. The whole contention around this plan that was put into play not by consultation and engagement with the community. It was done by a couple of ministers within the Conservative government, and two in particular, but there was others who were involved. It was Minister Baird and Minister Kenney who decided to push this relocation. And that's the problem. The problem is not the idea itself. It's the location. And from the beginning, that's what has been the opposition to this project.
Can I interrupt you? Could you just, please, for people in Ottawa are very familiar with this, and your home riding is Ottawa Centre. That's why we're talking to you. But for people outside, can you just briefly describe for someone who maybe doesn't know the Parliamentary Hill precinct very well, like, where was this site originally, the first monument, and where'd they move it to?
Well, if people familiar with Ottawa, let's take them down to the War Museum, and it's kind of situated near to the Ottawa River. And if you're coming from, and if people who have been to Ottawa know, or you can certainly do this on Google Maps, just take Wellington up towards Parliament Hill. So if you're taking the parkway onto Wellington from the War Museum, you'll, as soon as you get through the satellites just after going to the bridge to Gatineau, on the right-hand side is the location that they had intended the memorial to be.
Close to the areas where visitors to Ottawa, looking at the sort of main, you know, sites in the capital, would
absolutely
be close to it. Okay, so
absolutely.
Then they moved it to...
So then if we now take ourselves down Wellington a bit further, so it's in between the front lawn of the Supreme Court and the National Archive building.
So very prominent locations.
Extraordinarily important key piece of real estate. In fact, so important that back in 2007, Parliament passed what we called the long-term vision plan. But it basically was what you would call an official plan for the area. And they had thought deeply about this and had some of the best minds in architecture and planning and consulted widely on this plan to put a building there and to balance things accordingly so that on the north side, the side of Parliament Hill, you would have symmetry, you would have what would make sense on that side. And this location that was planned for something else in the future, along with greening the whole area around there, was totally dismissed by the Conservative cabinet ministers, who just simply wrote to the Minister of Public Works to say, let's move it. And without any consultations with the public, without any real consultations with people in the precinct, certainly, like MPs and others, and against the will of the mayor and the city council of Ottawa, against the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, who obviously has something to say because it's by the Supreme Court, against architects and planners from right across the country who have signed a letter against this. There is, in fact, even a public opinion poll that was done with 86% of people who were polled against this project.
So let's stipulate that there's been a lot of opposition. It's been a controversial idea, this monument, both the design and the location.
Yep.
Let me play devil's advocate for a minute.
Sure.
Isn't what the NCC talked about this week, which is scaling down the memorial, making it a little less obvious from the street, a little less dominant in the sort of sight lines to the Supreme Court building, isn't that at least a compromise? Why would that not meet with at least maybe not wholehearted approval from people who didn't like the old design, but at least it's better than what was there prior?
If that would work, if it was a matter of there had been a wider consultation to say that we should change the whole long-term vision plan, that the plan that was approved by Parliament needs to be opened up, and that we need to look at having something else there, and this is the something else, and then getting approvals and allowing for due process to happen. But they didn't do that. And in fact, what's really interesting today is the document that they put out on the recommendation to the board. It included a document that came from the Advisory Committee on Planning and Design and Realty of the NCC. And in it, the first bullet, this is a memorandum that was provided to the NCC from its own Advisory Committee on Planning and Design, which they have, which makes sense, right? These are architects and planners. And in the first bullet, it says, the committee does not support and cannot recommend the location of the memorial to the victims of communism on or any monument on this site. So they had already been told not to, you know, just scale it down and that's okay. They've been told, don't put a monument in this particular location. And that
this
was
by
news
their
to me
own,
today.
Their own in-house experts.
Their own in-house advisory committee. So what happened is that they went out to get another opinion, and that's what came out today, and it was scaled back. So, you know, it really does show that this was done with hubris, with political maneuvering, and it wasn't about what is the best option for this monument. And I should tell your listeners as well, it's really important, at the original site was agreed to and was planned out through consultation with the NCC, working with everyone in tandem. And, you know, as far as we were concerned, that was the way the plan was going to go until 2012, we now find out, through access to information documents that I received, that Ministers Baird and Kenny involved themselves.
That was Maclean's Ottawa Bureau Chief John Geddes in conversation with Paul Dewar, the NDP MP for Ottawa Centre. That's it for this week's episode. But remember to check out the Maclean's pop culture podcast, The Thrill, and our podcast about books, Bibliopod.
We'd also like to let you know the show will be going on a brief hiatus for the month of July. We will be back, though, just as the four major party leaders sit down with Paul Wells for the Maclean's Leaders Debate on Thursday, August 6th. It will be the first leaders debate for this election and will be aired on Maclean's.ca, City News, Omni, and it will be streamed online by Rogers Radio news stations across the country. For more of your politics and power, remember to tune back in to The Hill.